Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Washington Post called her the 21st century daughter of Chinua Achebe, Nigeria's most famous writer. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie was born and raised in Nigeria. She came to America to study when she was 19. Her prize-winning novels, Purple Hibiscus and Half a Yellow Sun, were set in Nigeria. In her new book, she divides her focus between Nigerians living in their own country as well as in America. The title of her new book is The Thing Around Your Neck. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Chimamanda, how good to meet you.
It's lovely to be here.
I must say, the title of your book is so intriguing. Tell us about that title story, When a Young Girl Wins a Lottery.
Mm. So it's about a Nigerian young woman who wins the American Visa lottery, which is much coveted, and comes to the U.S. And I suppose she struggles to adapt and to negotiate this new space. And she meets somebody and falls in love, I don't know, maybe, and has
maybe
a relationship.
Yes.
And as somebody who happens to be white and from the American upper classes, that interesting group that Americans like to deny exists. And so I think for me, it's a story about moving to a new place and trying to make sense of it. And also about about class and race.
About class and race. And the young man she met seemed genuinely interested in her and in learning about her. He had been to countries all over the world. He seemed to be genuinely enthralled with her. Why did she turn away?
I think, we don't know that she did.
It's very ambiguous, isn't it?
It is. I think that he did very much help her to make sense, that in some ways he helped her, that America was more doable for her because of him. But I think there's also the element of that power dynamics was obviously there, that here was somebody who could afford to travel the world and discover himself, which is something that had never occurred to her that people could in fact do, because she came from a poor background in Nigeria where you didn't have choices of that sort. And I think that maybe at some level that she might have worried that he saw her as some kind of trophy, some kind of sort of exotic, and that maybe his interest in her was less about the person that she was and more about the identity labels that she carried.
It's interesting that you use the phrase power dynamics, because that seems to be what's at work in each of the stories.
I am very interested in power. I think that I think human relationships are often conditioned by power, and that, you know, that in the thing about power, the thing that I find interesting is how in some spaces one is powerful, in other spaces that same person isn't powerful.
When you say in one species,
what space?
Spaces, yes. Forgive me. Yes. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. And I do believe that whether you're talking about marriage and the relationship, the space that a man holds and a woman holds, those can change even within the same space.
Oh, yes, I think so. And I think it depends on circumstances that, you find that in general, I think, that we live in a world that, and it really doesn't matter where, I think that generally we live in a world that favors men as a group. But of course, individual men can be in positions of very, very little power. And I think that marriage is, I find marriage is very interesting. I sort of like to observe. I'm a very unapologetic eavesdropper, and and I never mind my business. And I'm the sort of person who sits in a restaurant and I'm watching couples because I'm trying to figure out what sort of relationship they have just by watching.
Chimamanda, I do exactly the same thing. I'm fascinated whether there is conversation going on, whether there is animation
in the body language.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And all of those things can tell you a lot about power. The power between them.
Tell me about the power in which you were raised.
I grew up in a small university town called Nsukka, and had a very happy childhood. And actually, when I came to the US and I realized that writers were supposed to have had very sad and terrible childhoods, I then started to wonder whether I should invent horrible things that had happened to me.
What did your parents do?
My father was a professor. My mother worked as an administrator. She retired as registrar, which is sort of she retired as the head of the non-administrative unit of the university. And so I grew up the fifth of six children. And my family was sort of very open, moderately Catholic. So we went to mass every Sunday. And just really sort of ordinary and happy and very close-knit. We still are. And, but I was very much aware. I mean, I think that both parents walked and sort of went to work at the same time and came back. At the same time, I remember that my parents always had lunch together and that if one was late, the other always waited. And this was sort of something that was very constant in my childhood.
Now, was luncheon the major meal of the day?
For them.
I see.
For them. My father usually skipped dinner. So they would have a very late lunch at about 4, 3:30, 4 when they came back from work. And so growing up, my mother worked. And so for me, it was normal that, you know, women worked. And my mother didn't necessarily sort of do the... She didn't think that because I was a girl, I had to go to the kitchen and my brothers didn't have to. So my brothers cook. But at the same time, I realized that this wasn't necessarily the norm, that we did live in a society that believed that that roles should be based on gender, that you should cook because you're female, not necessarily because you're good at knowing how to saute. Right? So I think my mother was a bit different in some ways. But I suppose it doesn't mean that I wasn't aware of gender dynamics in the society in which I lived.
Did you see gender dynamics playing out between you and your brothers?
I don't. If I did, I really I'm not consciously aware of it. If anything, no, I really don't think so.
What do they do?
What do they do now? Mm-hmm. I have a brother who lives in England who's an engineer, and I have a brother who lives here in the US who does things with computers that it's not very clear to me. And I have a brother, I have a brother who lives in Nigeria who's sort of the white sheep of the family.
The white sheep? How fascinating. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Pronounce it.
Adichie.
Adichie. Good. The Thing Around Your Neck is the title of her new book of stories. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. As we talked about the title story, how did you define the thing around her neck?
I suppose it might be that kind of loneliness, that kind of sense of isolation and alienation that comes with being in a different place, trying to create home in a new place. And I think what's interesting about leaving home is that you never can. I mean, in some ways, home becomes something in your head because Nigeria is no longer home because you've left. And America never really is home because it's different and it's not yours. And so in the end, home becomes this gray space that's really in your head.
Mm. How long have you been in this country?
I have lived here off and on for 11 years.
And when you first came here, what was that adjustment like?
I remember, I mean, I had, my family had visited the U.S. when I was younger, because my father had done a sort of a teaching thing in San Diego. So it wasn't my first time in the U.S. when I came at 19 to go to university. It was, however, my first sort of, I had come to stay for a while, and I was alone. And although my sister did live in the U.S., I remember being, I think my major reaction was surprise at how little people around me knew about where I had come from. And I didn't, you know, considering America's cultural dominance, I had been watching lots of The Cosby Show and Dallas and things of that sort in Nigeria. So I didn't necessarily expect Americans to know as much about my world as I knew about theirs. But it was the sort of, you know, had you ever seen a car before you came to America, and do you have houses in Africa? That really surprised me. And this in a college, you know, it was sort of freshmen like me. And so that was both surprising and quite annoying. So it was sort of, I think that I went through a phase of, and I think what that does to you is that it makes your sense of isolation even more, it makes it almost grim, because you start to wonder if you exist, if that makes sense. Because, and this is the thing about when you're somebody who comes from what I like to call the regions that are in the periphery of the global world, you know, you just start to, yeah, it's a strange thing.
The thing around your neck is the title of a new book by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And we look forward to hearing from you. And the phones are open, 800-433-8850. In one of your stories, Chimamanda, you talk about a big man in Nigeria as part of your story, Imitation. Would you read some of that for us?
So this is a story about a woman who lives in Philadelphia. She's married to the big man in Nigeria, and they have a house in Nigeria and a house in Philadelphia. And she has domestic help that has been brought to her from Nigeria called Amichi. So this is a scene with the help and the woman, the big man's wife. Amichi is shaking the colander full of spinach leaves when Nkem says, "Your Oga Obiora has a girlfriend who has moved into the house in Lagos." Amichi drops the colander into the sink. "Madam, you heard me," Nkem says. She and Amichi talk about which Rugrats character the children mimic best, how Uncle Ben's is better than Basmati for jollof rice, how American children talk to elders as if they were their equals, but they have never talked about Obiora except to discuss what he will eat or how to launder his shirts when he visits. "How do you know, madam?" Amichi asks, finally, turning around to look at Nkem. "My friend Ijima Maka called and told me. She just got back from Nigeria." Amichi is staring at Nkem boldly, as though challenging her to take back her words. "But madam, is she sure?" "I am sure she would not lie to me about something like that," Nkem says, leaning back on her chair. She feels ridiculous to think that she's affirming that her husband's girlfriend has moved into her home. Perhaps she should doubt it. She should remember Ijimamaka's brittle envy, the way Ijimamaka always has something tear her down to say. But none of this matters because she knows it is true. A stranger is in her home. And it hardly feels right referring to the house in Lagos, in the Victoria Garden City neighborhood where mansions skulk behind high gates, as home. This is home. This brown house in suburban Philadelphia with sprinklers that make perfect water arcs in the summer. When Ogalbiora comes next week, madam, you will discuss it with him, Amichi says with a resigned air, pouring vegetable oil into a pot. He will ask her to move out. It is not right moving her into your house. So after he moves her out, then what? You will forgive him, madam. Men are like that. Nkem watches Amichi, the way her feet, encased in blue slippers, are so firm, so flatly placed on the ground. What if I told you he has a girlfriend? Not that she has moved in, only that he has a girlfriend. I don't know, madam. Amichi avoids Nkem's eyes. She pours onion slices into the sizzling oil and backs away at the hissing sound. You think your Oga Obiora has always had girlfriends, don't you? Amichi stirs the onions. Nkem senses the quiver in her hands. It is not my place, madam. I would not have told you if I did not want to talk to you about it, Amichi. But, madam, you know too. I know? I know what? You know Oga Obiora has girlfriends. You don't ask questions, but inside you know. Nkem feels an uncomfortable tingle in her left ear. What does it mean to know, really? Is it knowing, her refusal to think concretely about other women, her refusal to ever consider the possibility? Ogalbiora is a good man, madam, and he loves you. He does not use you to play football. Amichi takes the pot off the stove and looks steadily at Nkem. Her voice is softer, almost cajoling. Many women would be jealous. Maybe your friend, Ijimamaka, is jealous. Maybe she's not a true friend. There are things she should not tell you. There are things that are good if you don't know. Nkem runs her hand through her short curly hair, sticky with the texturizer and curl activator she had used earlier. Then she gets up to rinse her hand. She wants to agree with Amichi that there are things that are best unknown. But then she's not so sure anymore. Maybe it is not such a bad thing that Ijimamaka told me, she thinks. It no longer matters why Ijimamaka called. Check the potatoes, she says.
And at that very moment, the power structure changes.
Yes.
Just extraordinary.
One of the things that, for me, the story is about a woman finding her voice. Mm. And in a very small way. But this is a woman who's so choked up with the gratitude of having been married by this big, wealthy man who can give her everything. And so she's just never spoken. And so she's sort of always gone along with all the plans he made. And that for her, this becomes a realization that, you know, I can, in fact, have a voice.
He adores her long, beautiful hair. Mm. And what has she done just before that conversation? She has cut it close to her scalp. Mm. Another exercise of power.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
The subtle ways in which people deal with each other. There is yet another story which introduces homosexuality into your writing, and the professor who is purportedly teaching this class says that homosexuality has no place in Nigerian writing.
He says that it's not authentically African, because it's about a writer's workshop, and one of the writers has written a story, an autobiographical story about her, the woman she loves, and she's told by this man that, oh, you know, it's not authentically African. And I think for me, and there are other stories, there's another story in this book, actually the story that's sort of very close to my heart called The Shivering, which is in which there's also a gay character who forms an unlikely friendship with a Nigerian man who's gay who forms an unlikely friendship with a Nigerian woman in Princeton. And I think for me, because there's a sort of a formalized kind of silence around homosexuality in Nigeria. And I think in all of sub-Saharan Africa that we just choose, denial is easier. So we'll say things like, oh, it's really from the West, which amuses me greatly. And I just feel that it's something that, and the reason I think it's even more important to talk about it and acknowledge it is because it's, you know, because it affects the dignity and humanity of the people involved. There are people who are gay, who are just as human as the rest of us. And for us to deny them what they are, I think, is to deny something human in all of us.
And certainly in this country, there is a denial among African-American preachers, mm-hmm. pastors, that that homosexuality mm-hmm. should be allowed mm. as part of what's happening in America.
I think I do think though that I mean, there's a lot of talk about it in African American community about it being something particular to African Americans. I do think that there's a stronger element of it. It's so much more about religion than it is about. I mean, I feel that there are as many non-African American religious leaders who feel that way as well. The sorts of people who
Absolutely.
Want to pray and have sort of cast out what is called the gay demon from people and that kind of thing, which really for me is just sad.
Chimamanda, what was your own experience coming to academia when you first came to this country?
I absolutely loved college. I loved the American and continue to love. I have a huge crush on the liberal arts education system. I think it's fantastic. And I had in Nigeria, the reason I came to the US was because I didn't want to become a doctor. So I was fleeing the study of medicine.
Who wanted you to be a doctor?
When you're from my background, when you sort of, you do well in school and you sort of come from this academic middle class background, you're expected to become a doctor. It's almost automatic. And I remember in secondary school having taken one of the major exams and one of my teachers said, oh, of course you're going to be a doctor. You made the best grades. And I think I accepted this because it just happened to be, you know, nobody ever said to you, you'll become a writer. People looked at you very strangely if you talked about wanting to be a writer. So I remember thinking, I'm going to become a doctor so that I can earn a living. And then I will do what I really love, what I've done since I was six, which is write. And at the same time, I was sort of plotting to be a psychiatrist so I could mine the lives of my patients for material for my fiction. So I had it all planned. And then I, after a year and a half of medical school, I just realized how unhappy I would be. Hmm. I was writing poetry in classes on physiology. I was so bored. And so I just knew I had to do something. So I left.
How did your parents feel?
My parents are remarkable people because they completely went against the grain. And they said to me, are you sure? I said, yes. And they said, okay. And now, if you sort of know the kind of background I come from, it's very odd. You don't leave medical school. It's very difficult to get in. And it's such a thing. I mean, all parents want to be called the parents of doctors. And so, but I like to tease my parents and to say to them that because my sister was already a doctor, they could afford to be nice to me and let me go.
Did you perceive the sort of, you talked about how in freshman year, young Americans seem to be less than knowledgeable about Africa. But did you perceive yourself being talked down to because you were African?
I did feel that I was sort of the recipient of a kind of generic and syrupy pity. And that this pity came from just being from this generic space called Africa. And so I just felt that, you know, that for many of them, the assumption was that I had come from this place where we were all sort of hopelessly poor. It was either that or I had come from a place where, you know, we sort of lived in some sort of savage nobility and had giraffes and lions for pets. And because you will not believe how many people talk to me about wild animals. And, you know, I come from urban Nigeria. I've never even seen a bloody giraffe. And, well, except for in the zoo.
In the zoo.
And so I didn't, I mean, it wasn't, yes. Yeah, so there was sort of a level of condescension, but it was more of a pity. It was, you know, we're sorry for you. You know, Africa, we feel really bad. And it was something that took a lot of getting used to. Because initially I really didn't understand why I had to be the recipient of pity until I started to, you know, sort of educate myself on the cultural assumptions, because it's very strange when you're in Nigeria, you don't quite know how you're looked at. You don't know. But being here, you sort of, you watch and you see that media images of where you come from follow a particular line.
And of course, Biafra and the war in Biafra was certainly part of perhaps what Americans were thinking at that time.
Mm. I actually think that the images from Biafra started the kind of the way that Africa has been covered ever since, which is sort of the exclusive and unrelenting focus on, you know, the starving child. And almost something almost pornographic about it, I think. And I think Biafra was the beginning. I mean, the coverage of Biafra had some good things about it, which is that it made the world aware, which I think was an important thing. But that in the bid, I think, to create compassion, that they might have gone overboard and then sort of created this image that has continued to be replicated by different kinds of media.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we have many callers waiting. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Charlotte, North Carolina. Anastasia, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Great to be on your show. Chimamanda, I just wanted to say I see myself so much in you. I also came from Nigeria when I was 17, came here for college, and also Catholic. Parents worked at UNILAG, which is a university, so I definitely see myself a lot. I think I've read all your books. I think my favorite was Half of a Yellow Sun, and the reason I enjoyed it so much was because it talked about the Civil War, and I feel like a lot of Nigerians of my generation, I'm 22, have this kind of amnesia where in all the history classes I ever took, we never learned about the Civil War, and so it's like we're trying to forget that whole period and erase it from our memory. So I just wanted to say it was so great to actually hear you write about it, because a lot of the stuff in your, a lot of the details in your book, I was hearing from the first time, and my parents were so reluctant, because I talked about it with my parents, and they were so reluctant to talk about it. It was almost they wanted to erase that time from their minds. So it was really great to hear and read your book. And I haven't read this new one, but I'm definitely going to get it.
You will enjoy it, Anastasia.
I think that I think she's right. I think she's absolutely right about the silence surrounding the subject of the Nigerian Biafra War. And I remember when I was working on Half of a Yellow Sun, which was a very difficult book for me to do emotionally, technically, in all sorts of ways, people said to me, leave that alone. It's in the past. Mm. Don't start trouble, that sort of thing. But I also think that, you know, all countries have parts of their past that make them uncomfortable, and they would rather pretend that it didn't exist. And I just sort of feel very strongly about the need. We can't move forward unless we know where we've come from. And I have a lot of hope in Nigerians of my generation, not in my parents' generation, unfortunately. I've given up on those. But my generation, I have a lot of hope in. And I feel that the only way we can sort of collectively move forward and change the country is if we know where we've come from. And so Half of a Yellow Sun, I think, has become a starting point for conversations. And I feel very happy to hear back from people like her.
Indeed. You know, many years ago, I think it would have been in about 1986, I had the pleasure of having Chinua Achebe on the program. It was the first live radio interview he had ever done, and I was absolutely mesmerized. Mm. Now, a great many people are comparing you and calling you his daughter. There is a coincidence there that your parents, your family, lived at one time in his home. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
It is, but it was actually a house that belonged to the university. So in Nsukka.
So it was the same house in which he lived.
Yes, so his family had just moved out and we moved in. And I really didn't, I mean, it was just a coincidence. I didn't quite realize what a spectacular coincidence it was until much later, just before my book was published. And since then, it has become the most interesting thing about my biography.
What feeling does that comparison raise in you?
I think, Chinua Achebe is the writer whose work is most important to me. And I like to say that his work gave me permission to write. And he's also a man, I think, who he's a man of just immense integrity. So I deeply respect him. And so to be compared to him, you know, it isn't too bad.
Yeah, not too bad. The book we're talking about this morning is titled The Thing Around Your Neck. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is with me. When we come back, more of your questions, comments, your email. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What did President Obama read at night after putting down the briefing books? Netherland by novelist Joseph O'Neill. The New York Times called it the wittiest, angriest, most exacting, and most desolate work of fiction we've yet had about life in New York and London after the World Trade Center fell. Joseph O'Neill is our guest on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Welcome back. It's time for more of your calls, your comments. Here's an email from Carol, who says, your guest is immersed in both cultures and uniquely qualified to present stories from them both. I have long heard an unpleasant rumor that Nigerians do not feel any kinship with us. Has this social phenomenon surfaced in your life or writing experience? If so, can you explain its persistence as a rumor or an American reality?
Would us be African Americans or Americans in general?
Americans in general.
I don't think that's...
Friction between... No, it is, forgive me, it is Nigerians and African-Americans.
I thought it would be.
Yeah.
I think there is some truth to that. I think there is quite a bit of tension between, and not just Nigerians, I think in general the African immigrant community and the African-American community. When I came to the U.S., one of the things that I think I discovered about America was race. I discovered when I came to the U.S. that I was black. And, I mean, it's shocking considering my deep chocolate tone, but I hadn't quite, I mean, race didn't figure where it came from. And I think it's being West African. And if I had, for example, been maybe from East or Southern Africa, it would have been different because I think that race is something that's very present for them, but not for us. So I came to the US and I discovered that I was black. And I will never forget the moment in Brooklyn when I made this great discovery and an African-American man had called me sister. And I remember just being horrified and thinking, he thinks I'm black. And I had been in the US long enough, of course, being about a month, to learn that you didn't want to be black in America, that black came with a lot of sort of negative sort of cultural formulations, and that if it was possible, one had to avoid being black. And so I didn't want him to call me sister. But what's interesting, of course, is that I feel that I've come full circle, that from that sort of the day that I was called sister and that I rejected that label, I then, through reading, which was very important for me, learning about African-American culture and history, which I really knew very little about, having friends who were African-American, sort of being educated in the US, just learning America, I've come full circle. I've become happily black. But but I think it's something that not all African immigrants do or go through. And part of it, I think, is ignorance, that there isn't a lot of knowledge on both sides about both cultures, that Africans don't know a lot about African-American history in particular. And that because of that, it's very easy when African immigrants come to the US to absorb the negative stereotypes of African-Americans. And that often these immigrants are so focused on that kind of immigrant zeal to succeed that, you know, they just don't make, in my opinion, too much of an effort.
Do you think that the rise to the presidency of Barack Obama can make a difference in that divide?
I don't know. I'm lately starting to think that that we, you know, Barack Obama will be asked to change water into wine next. I mean, there's so many hopes on the poor man that I'm starting to sort of feel worried and sorry. And I don't know whether it will. I do think that Barack Obama is immensely popular among Africans. Well, really all over the world, isn't he? But I think that there is a sense among Africans that he's ours, right? Even though he really is an American. I mean, you hardly knew his Kenyan father. But there's a sense in which we sort of take ownership of him, you know, one of us. But I don't know how it will affect the relationship between the African and African-American communities. I'm really not sure.
Let's take a caller in Dallas, Texas. Gabrielle, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm Diana, and this is Gabrielle again. I had a chance to meet Chimamanda when she was here in Dallas, I guess about a couple of weeks ago or two, 3 weeks ago, when she was reading her book. And it was really a pleasure for me to see a writer from Nigeria, and even more pleasure for me to see someone that is committed and to write about Africa and to write about Nigeria. Because, I mean, having been in the West for so long and having had so many different stories about Africa that most of which are misinformation, and hearing a writer just presenting what Africa truly is, I think that is really commendable, and I just want to encourage her to keep doing that, because we African here in the U.S., we do really need a writer like her, and I wish other African writers can follow our example, because we do really need U.S. to understand how we live in Africa and how we live in places like Nigeria.
Thank you so much for calling, Gabrielle. Any comment?
No, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Here's an email from Amiso. He's a Nigerian living in Fort Worth, Texas. Number one, what inspires Chimamanda in her writing? And number two, does she feel more Nigerian in America and more American in Nigeria?
What inspires you question, I just never know how to answer. Everything inspires me, right? I'm inspired by you, for example. I don't know. I think that my sensibility is Nigerian. And I think that because I didn't leave home until I was 19. So I sort of had my you know, I was fairly grown up. And so the eyes with which I look at the world are very Nigerian eyes, which is why sometimes I observe something in America and I shake my head and I say, only in America. But then on the other hand, I go back home and I'm sort of leaving for Nigeria today. And my friends will say to me just before we go out to eat, they will sort of warn me very carefully in the car, do not ask for steamed vegetables. Don't do that American thing. So apparently I seem to have some American things such as asking for steamed vegetables in restaurants, which Nigerians don't do. Our vegetables are drenched in oil.
Huh. And they're delicious.
They are, absolutely. The steamed, no, much more than the steamed ones. But I just have to, I have happened to have developed a taste for steamed vegetables.
For steamed vegetables, I can understand that. In that story from which you read, where the wife learns that her husband has moved his mistress into her home in Lagos, she thinks about what she would have to give up if she goes back to Nigeria. We should say that her husband comes to Philadelphia only 2 months out of the year. The rest of the time, he's in Nigeria, this big businessman. And she's thinking about all the things she would have to give up if she goes and resumes her place in Nigeria. Do you think about the things you have here, the things you don't have there, or what you would have to give up if you went back there permanently?
I think maybe not, and maybe it's because I'm really very fortunate to be able to do both. That I spend, last year I spent much more time in Nigeria, maybe 7 or 8 months of the year. But this year I think I'm going to spend more time here in the U.S.
And why?
Because I need to, I'm planning to go into self-made hibernation. And it's sometimes becoming more difficult to do that when I'm at home in Nigeria.
Do you mean a hibernation to write?
Yes, hopefully. is the hope. I've been doing so much travel in the past few months and I've just, you know, I just sort of want space and silence and solitude. And I just thought about, I think it was Don DeLillo who is said to have said that writers go out of their way to secure their solitude, which is what I want to do. But having secured their solitude, they go out of their way to squander it, which I might also do. But I think that for me, and I often say that Nigeria is the home of my heart. It's where I feel much more emotionally invested, where I want to be involved and give back and all of those things. And America is the home of wonderful convenience where I don't have to worry about electricity going off, where I can have my steamed vegetables. I do feel very fortunate to have both.
All right, let's take a caller in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Patrick. You're on the air.
Good morning. Chimamanda, I remember you as a child and completely surprised but delighted about the woman that you've become. Thank you very much for your writing. I just had a really quick question, and that's Nigeria is a place, I'm Nigerian, with deeply incisive lines across class, across experiences, etc. And not such an easy place to do your research from, to find out about other people's experiences. Reading your books has been very much of an education for me, even though I grew up in Nigeria. And so I wanted to know how you were able to transport yourself into the minds of people whose backgrounds, for example, you may not have shared, how you've been able to succeed in doing this. But most of all, I just wanted to end by saying thank you very much for the great gift that you've given to all of us. I hope that you carry on writing. It's a delight to read your books.
I wish I'd sort of, he remembers me as a child.
Yes, Patrick. How do you remember Chimamanda as a child?
I remember as a child I had a big crush on your sister and went to school with your brother, went to the same boarding school with your brother. So I've known your family for a long time and just remember you back in Nsukka when I was a freshman in medical school.
Which of my sisters?
Both of your sisters.
Oh, I see.
No, I had a crush on Uche, but...
Okay, I will make sure to let her know.
I think she does know this, but...
I have two amazing, beautiful sisters.
You are beautiful, and our listeners should know that.
My sister's amazing looking, really. But the question about, I mean, class is something I'm very interested in. And I think in Nigeria, we don't talk enough about class. And we very often reduce things to ethnicity as though, and I think that class divides can sometimes be more important than ethnic divides.
Help me to understand the ethnic and class
so
divides.
So we in Nigeria have, I think we're supposed to have about 200 different ethnic groups, but maybe 10 major ones. And I mean, it's northern Nigeria, mostly Hausa speaking and mostly Muslim. Southern Nigeria, the major ones are the Igbo, I am Igbo, there's the Yoruba, the Ijo, and we're mostly Christian. And very often we sort of reduce conflict to either religion or ethnicity. But then class, which is really in Nigeria, either based on education or wealth, I think really connects people and divides people. And for example, in one of the stories here, The Shivering, that I talked about earlier, you sort of have this woman who in Nigeria would never have connected to this man because this man is sort of from a lower class. He's a village, rural person. And comes from a world that people in her world would look down on and consider, you know, not quite. And I'm very interested in this. And in my novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, I have a character who is a houseboy, who really, for me, is the heart of the book and the center of the book. And he's also the character that I feel most like him. But then he's the character whose background is nothing like mine because he's from this rural village and who, you know, in Nigeria, I often say to my friends, we must acknowledge our class privilege. It's very important to, because not to do it is to be dishonest and to somehow believe in this idea of a kind of sort of merit that falls from the sky. I mean, because one speaks English properly, for example, in Nigeria, one is immediately open to all kinds of privileges. Because one went to a certain kind of school, because I was fortunate to go to a school that my parents didn't have to pay for because it was a university school. It was free, but it was very good. And so I think in many ways it set it up for me to, you know, there are jobs that I could easily get in Nigeria because of that, that somebody else who might be just as qualified, but who might have grown up in a rural area and doesn't speak English the same way, wouldn't get it. So, I mean, I think for me, it's a very important thing to acknowledge that class privilege.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You enrolled to do a master's degree in African studies at Yale. What was that like for you?
It was interesting. I met lovely people, which means it wasn't an entire waste of 2 years. But I think that what it taught me is that academia isn't for me. I felt that academia is often about academia, and that I was very interested in the messiness of the real world, and that I didn't always feel that academia grappled sufficiently with the sort of messiness of the real world as I wanted it, that it didn't quite do it in the way that I was interested in. I felt almost that my creativity was stifled.
Really? Stifled?
Yes. and it's a fantastic program, the African Studies program at Yale. It's the sort of place I would recommend to anybody who wanted to do academia. But I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller. And I had gone there hoping that somehow it would nourish my writing. But I don't know that it did. And I think also that I was really heartbroken that I wasn't allowed to do a creative thesis. Because I'd wanted to sort of do something creative, but based, of course, on research, and I wasn't allowed to. And what struck me, of course, was thinking that my novel was taught in some classes there, and I thought, this is what I do well, right? Half of a Yellow Sun was a novel based on research. I mean, a lot of the events in the book are verifiable. I did a lot of work, but it's a novel, and I had wanted to do something similar. But the committees that decide these things decided that I couldn't. And it's also interesting, I think it raises questions of sort of, you know, that whole idea of the way that the academic world looks at creative work. And I remember once reading about the Nigerian Nobel Prize winner, Wole Soyinka, who, and I think, I'm not sure if he said this or somebody said this about him, but a lot of lecturers at a university in Nigeria had made their careers from his writing, from his creative work. But then when he went to the university and wanted to create something similar, they said no, he couldn't. But they had actually made their careers in literature and literary studies from the work that he had done. So it's an interesting question, I think.
And what's next?
I don't know. I think I have an idea of what I want to do next, but I'm too superstitious to talk about
it. I understand. But seeking that enforced isolation is certainly in your near future.
Yes, yes.
Well, I congratulate you on this book. It's it is so moving and so powerful in each of the stories you've written. It's just remarkable.
Thank you so much.
And Lynn, thank you, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her new book is titled The Thing Around Your Neck. Thanks to all of you for listening, for calling, for sending in your email. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.